Welcome to the first installment of Enlightening Dialogues. My name is Gabriel Cavalli and I'm director of LIGHT, the Leeds Institute for Teaching Excellence. And in a world increasingly fast-pacing and with 30-second videos and soundbites and everyone on the screen, the idea of Enlightening Dialogues is to provide some deeper insights and reflections emerging from just having a chat and let the magic emerge. Enlightening Dialogues, I like a pun. And what a first installment. I'm delighted to have here outstanding guests. So I will ask them to introduce themselves and briefly tell us what you may think appropriate about yourselves for today. So, Margaret, who are you?
What a confronting first question. Who am I? My name is Margaret Bierman. I'm a research professor at the Centre for Research and Assessment in Digital Learning, CRADLE, at Deakin University in Melbourne, Australia. And I guess I research what it says on the tin, assessment and digital learning. I have particular interests in feedback, generative AI, and as I think we're going to be discussing about what sustains changes in educational practice.
Brilliant. And we also have Jeff. Jeff, who are you?
So did I hear you say that we have to be enlightening and the conversation is supposed to generate magic? Could you set, could we set a bar a little bit lower?
No pressure.
No pressure whatsoever. So I'm Jeff Grable. I'm the Deputy Vice Chancellor for Student Education at the University of Leeds and spent most of my career in U.S. higher education, 20 years in particular at Michigan State University, where I was a researcher of rhetoric and digital communication, which I think we'll come back to in terms of design arts, and also in the provost office developed and led an educational innovation function within the institution to try to move that institution around some difficult corners with regard to what education might need to look like in the early to mid 21st century. So a little bit about who I am. Nothing magical in that particular introduction, Gabriel, but hopefully useful.
And last but not least, Robert, who are you?
Who am I? So my name is Robert Averies. I'm a research and impact officer at the Leeds Institute for Teaching Excellence, where I support development and impact of a wide range of pedagogic research projects. I have a teaching and educational leadership background in international adult education. And this is where I saw my assumptions about teaching and learning and its wider purpose continually challenged. And that taught me the value of applying a reflective lens, whether that's in an academic sense or more in my day-to-day work. As Maxine Green put it, asking yourself, what are we as educators trying to bring into being? And I hope that kind of perspective will lend itself well to this discussion and I can provide some useful reflective insights for listeners.
So Robert is one of the multiple deep thinkers at LIGHT and is here to bring a feature of Enlightening Dialogues that we call Tell Me What You See, or in this case, Tell Me What You Hear. A bit like tearing down the fourth wall and bring ever so often, for the sake of our audience, a different perspective. And it's not about agreeing or disagreeing with the dialogue itself between here Margaret and Jeff, but to remind us, what does what we hear sound like? Is there some other reading, interpretation, or connection to anything else that our audience may find inspiration from? And it doesn't even have to be within the subject of the conversation. It can simply be, it reminds me of a book or a film by whomever.
We already got a Maxine Green reference, which is
absolutely.
Get them in early.
Yeah, no, you've earned your keep already.
So are we ready?
Sure.
Okay, so let me start with Margaret. What really caught LIGHT's attention in your work, Margaret, which is impressive and in the depth and breadth of it, but particularly was your work in sustainability of teaching and learning innovations in higher education. So what attracted you to this topic?
I've had a very long-standing interest. What makes things stick. I mean, we spend a lot of time in education, and I think you probably, everyone in this room and maybe everyone listening, given it's magic and all that kind of gear, has been involved in a very beloved educational piece of work that you put your heart and soul into, and then you blinked and it was gone. It dissipated, and all this love and care, and in fact you might even say the impact that it was having, just evaporated. To give a very simple example, when the very first project I was involved in when I was in my very early 20s, and this dates me so strongly, I was hired as my first RA role to do a multimedia package on HIV/AIDS. And this was at a time before acyclovir, so it was actually a package about, you know, really managing social conditions, stigma, what could not be done in a very terrible time. And by the time I'd finished the package, I was very proud of it. It was a wonderful piece of work. The drug regime had happened, and of course that was fabulous. Nothing better. And if you want to see your work go up in a piece of smoke, that is the best way to do it, because it really shifted everything. But it was really the first thing I ever did was a striking reminder of how innovation has time and place and moment, and what is it, where should we invest, how do we sustain things forward, and when is it time sometimes to let things go and say they've done their job?
That's fantastic way of setting us off. Jeff, in your case, you have a keen interest and expertise in designing student experiences. How did you end up in that area?
Yeah, that's a good question. I sometimes don't know how I ended up in that area. Maybe just a brief little kind of academic history. I mean, Margaret used a rhetorical term in terms of talking about time, manner, place. That's the rhetorical concept of kairos, which is a very powerful concept that I'm happy to go on and on about, but won't. But that's my disciplinary background, which is a field of study and practice, largely North American, I think, in its current form, and is a design art, and rhetoric is, I think, usefully understood in a colloquial way as the art of changing the world through language. And to do that, you have to design rhetorical interventions, communications, engagements with people around who they are, where they are, and what they need. So it's a design art. And so I've pulled that through my career. I don't think anybody in a school of design would own me, or maybe might own rhetoric as a discipline that belongs in a school of design. But we own ourselves in that space. And my field, certainly in terms of its 20th century representation in the U.S., has been braided with educational work. So literacy crises, in particular, tend to drive educational change and innovation at the school level and at the university level. And that's the case with my particular world, which was focused on writing in particular. And so the crisis of bringing people to universities who didn't belong in universities previously. So the successive waves in U.S. higher education of being more accessible to, beginning with the GI Bill and soldiers returning from the Second World War and having access to higher education, these are the great unwashed. And so I use that term with great irony. But it did drive changes in general education and the way in which we think about writing and maths in particular as something that is required of every university person. So that particular kind of teaching problem, like how do you help people learn how to write who may not see themselves as writers, who might have much writing experience. You combine those two things, my discipline, my field, my world, and me as an individual. My entire career has been marked by working at the level of design and also thinking very carefully about teaching a broad spectrum of university students. And so that gets me to a place where a university president or a provost looks at people like me, and in my case, me, and saying we need to do some innovative work around education, and you're one of the people at this particular institution. Your colleagues more broadly are the people who tend to think about educational innovation in a broad and accessible and thoughtful way. You know, will you be willing to do some work? So I get to that space not really by choice, but by doing the work, if you will, for a long period of time and being identified by a senior leader who says, I have a job for you, will you do the job? And I'm just too stupid to say no to those opportunities.
Can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
What do you enjoy about it?
What do I enjoy about
the job?
Yeah. So joy is the right word. I find the work that I've done at Leeds, which has been exceptionally difficult, and the work that I did, particularly the last 5-6 years at Michigan State, which is also very difficult, I derived a great deal of joy in that work, because we were doing something that mattered. The work was consequential, which is why it was difficult. And I got very interested over the last 10 years of my career in doing good things at scale. Mm-hmm. We have problems of sustainability and we have problems at scale, and they do intersect in particular sorts of ways. And I knew what I could do with a classroom of 20 students, and I knew what my program could do with a cohort of 150. But at 50,000 scale or planetary scale, if we really want to be crazy about how we think about educational innovation.
Magical,
right? The problems of scale are scale introduces new problems. And so I find those kinds of intellectual challenges, and I have found my leadership roles intellectual work, not management work. I sort of coil at being called a senior manager in the UK. I'm an intellectual, I think, and I try to bring that to my work and to the work that my colleague. We're trying to untie some really meaningful intellectual knots, and that's fun. And when you're trying to do it with an explicit interest and working with people and with the idea that if we untie this knot, their lives will be better, that's joyful.
What a lovely answer.
Oh, thank you.
So I suppose that actually looking at those perspectives, I mean, the obvious is trying to intersect them and I suppose the challenge, particularly from a perspective of what Light is working towards, it really takes me nicely to, can we in this space design for sustainability? And if so, you know, what does that mean and how do we go about it?
Well, so I'm going to kick it to Margaret because I read your paper on this expert.
Expert is strong. Interested. We have the interested. I think that one of my and I think it's interesting to hear you talk about the sorts of interventions you can make, because I do a lot of naturalistic on the ground work. I do it in healthcare. I do it in higher education. And one of the things that's really striking about it is how difficult sustained change is. And for a whole host of reasons, we often, a lot of the innovation work, and I'm doing, what do you call them here? Air quotes, I'd say bunny ears, but that sounds very childish. The innovation work is often tied to technology. You know, ChatGPT is a great example. There's a new technology, an iPhone, it comes. And a lot of the work on innovation change is this idea that you plonk the innovation in front of you, often a piece of technology, and it will naturally stay, it will stick, because it's a thing. But in education, what we're actually talking about is the way people do things. And there's some work, Neil Selwyn is probably the best known person who talks about this, that says that often when we bring in a new device or a new thing, our practices don't change. So we really just start channeling the things we've already done through the new devices that we have. So what does bring sustained change? It's unclear. I'm going to be really brutally honest. Mm-hmm. We know there's some things that matter. We know that what I'm just going to call roughly going with the grain matters. So you need to be in alignment with what everyone's thinking. And this is based on research and also on other people's research and also a bit of my own work, that, you know, that going with the flow of people is really important. If you have a particular way of thinking and doing, to come headstrong against it, you know, you're not going to be salmon swimming upstream. You're going to be carp swimming upstream. It's not going to happen. You're going to come back down. We know that leadership matters, intellectual leadership, even if we say, and that whole idea of governance supporting. We know that strange things like money help, but not as much as you might think. Time seems to be more important than money. There's some weird equation between the two, and it's not one-to-one. We know that people matter in higher ed. We know that educators matter, the collegiate teams matter, collaboration matters, and we know that students matter. So to go back to that very early, which I hope stays in this podcast, introduction about magic, there does seem to be a piece of magic where you can run two things that look pretty similar side by side, and one of them will stick mm-hmm. and one of them won't. And we have some clues as to why that happens, but I don't know if you can say what actually causes that magic. And I can say for a lot of times that it's not evidence. We know a lot about what best practice, good practice, what we ought to be doing is. I mean, think of all the things you ought to be doing. Are you doing them? Well, maybe not so much. How's that gym membership going? That kind of thing. We know, so knowing what something should be or what you aspire to is not the same as doing it. So there's a whole lot of conditions. And then finally, to add on to all of that, there's a really well-established pattern of human behaviour to return to what is familiar and what is known. And we revert to it. It's a very human thing to do, and that drives a lot of things. So even though people can start off with really good intention and really good desire, you can end up doing what you've already done. And, yeah, referring back to that gym membership again, you can see how that works in human behaviour all the time. I don't know if those things are a problem. I mean, if it was all simple, then where would be the intellectual challenge? Where would be the fun? We'd be turning out a bunch of very effective clones.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's a brilliant description, to be honest with you, of not just your work and the insights from your work, but at least my understanding of what the literature more broadly looks like. And what I hear you describing really exceptionally well is a system that in which the sum is very much greater than its parts, right? So all of those elements, you can change any one of them and get one of them right or three of them right, but they interact with the other elements of the system. I think in my experience that you talked about the grain, and I think you get change that's possibly sustainable when you change the grain. And to play with that metaphor, changing the grain of anything is really hard. And I think that does explain substantially why initial change is exceptionally challenging in education, and sustained change is even more challenging. I wonder though, so I don't know, can I ask Mark? So I don't expect you to have a definitive answer, but I wonder what you think about this kind of a question. Is the initial change harder or easier than sustaining the change?
Easier.
You think so?
Definitely.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because it's the once off. We know a lot about it. We know how to do it. And we can force change.
We can force it, right?
Yeah, yeah, and that's the change true. That doesn't stick.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I think it's easier.
Okay.
Before I bring in Robert, actually, I have a tell me what I hear, because this reminds me of last year at the Leeds Student Education Conference, we had Paul Ashwin from Lancaster, and he was actually talking about that. It's a different practice to research for innovation and then to be the one who receives it and applies it, and that it's, I think it he posed as a part of the problem that actually people are in different businesses when you're actually, you know, creating initial change to when this is actually passed on. Robert, are you ready to come in?
I suppose I've been thinking about your discussion in relation to my role and the people I work with at Light, i.e. Light fellows and colleagues, especially the work we're trying to do now, which is provide a better platform for Light fellows to evidence examples of impact. Everyone comes into, I'd like to think, a Light Fellowship because they want to make a change. They want the experience, they want to develop, and that's a kind of change, but they also want to change an aspect of student education that maybe they've noticed needs changing. And that's messy, that's complicated, and it's contested. There's no one right or wrong answer. And that's not a reason, as you said, not to do something. And in fact, that's exciting. And also having read your paper around that concept of sustainable innovation, it's a kind of oxymoron. You know, there's change, but also there's stability. And it's given me a whole load of questions, not necessarily answers, but questions around how we can support that and how we can provide that platform in the long term with people that we work with. And yeah.
Thank you. Margaret, just one thing, as I was actually bringing in this idea that people might be in different practices, were you frowning? You were clearly being very reflective. Is there something that you want to bring it on?
No, not at all. That is my thinking face.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And it gets me into trouble all the time. I once had a colleague who turned around and snapped around to me in the corridor and said, "Margaret, is something wrong?" I was like, "You look so angry." Oh, no, it's my thinking face on again. I can't even remember what I was thinking. I do
That's
look
all right.
very pensive when I think.
I think you're supposed to.
Wouldn't it be better, though, to look a little bit more, I mean, you know, I don't know, open and reflective rather than grumpy?
But the one thing that actually, and somehow you alluded to this already, but because in your Scorpion review, Margaret, you talk about sustainability of teaching innovations defined in terms of social practices associated with education, which actually, you know, sounds like a very messy definition of change in terms of like, how do you define it in concrete terms? And therefore, is there an implication for design when what you aspire to reach might be less well-defined?
I'm going to try and link social practice to design because I think they're really tightly coupled. I think design is part of social practice. We do it all the time. I mean, I'm talking to a design expert, but let me please indulge my musings on design that are not as well informed. I think it's part of a social practice. I think we do it all the time. I think we do a lot of design work all the time. And I think we don't think, I believe that it's beneficial to think about what we do in education almost all the time as a form of design, because that's what's open to us as teachers. It's to, you know, drawing from Peter Goodyear's work, it's to set up the spaces, the social interaction, if you like, the epistemic idea, the ideas, the content, and bring them together. And then we don't do the learning. We have done the teaching, the design, and the students inhabit what we have set up for them. And sometimes they do their thing that is quite different from what we necessarily intend. And he calls that learn time and design time. So in that world, social practices, the social practice of being a teacher is about design. There isn't really a separation. What I think is interesting, though, is that what drives that design, what drives people designing instinct and their social practices, what's available to them. I mean, we think of ourselves as being intellectuals, but at the same time, there's that craft element of design, you know, like we're like potters working with clay. You have the familiar equipment, models, modes, you know your clay, you know your students. And again, there are a whole range of practices built up about it. So for me, the reason I like to focus on it, and I don't think it's in any way contradictory to design, is it's not, although there are material elements, it is not the materiality in and of itself. It's like the innovation isn't some kind of product that descends, like my long-lost HIV/AIDS package that actually was a product, but mostly the innovation is something in higher education that's ongoing, that we keep doing. It's not the one-off. Does that answer the question?
I'm not sure if it answers the same question, but actually I think it's really productive. So, yeah, no, thanks very much. it's really insightful. I liked it. I mean, can I complicate the picture? I'm looking at Jeff, both from the point of view of the role that you inhabit right now at the University of Leeds, but also your background. And we've had some prior discussions on Derek Bok and Higher Expectations and writing from the US in terms of essentially educational reforms, so change and sustainability are at the heart of that. And there's a lot there about different types of institution. And I think that maybe the conversation has made a bit of an assumption that there's an average teacher, an average institution? You know, what happens in when we complicate the picture, and actually there's different motivations, different values, and different constraints as well.
I'll probably come back to design, because I thought your answer was excellent, because I think design is a kind of social practice, but it also is embedded in lots of social practices, and I thought you had an appropriately democratic and participatory notion of who designers are. We all design, and anytime we're moving from trying to move ourselves or others from the current state to a new state, that's a classic design setup, isn't it? But I'll respond to the Derek Bach work. I mean, we were talking about this on the walk over. I mean, he's a particular kind of, I don't want to be more broad than this, so let me Americanize. He's a particular kind of American higher educational intellectual who thinks a little bit about higher education as a thing. So his sense of the world and what higher education is like is a little bit more particular than maybe he lets on. And so higher education as a system is very diverse in different kinds of academics, different kinds of students, different kinds of institutional positioning. So his insights about higher education and why we don't provide an educational experience which aligns with what we know to be the best way to do it is, I still think they're useful insights. And more broadly, I mean, in the book that we were talking about, he identifies three impediments. And you know, one of them is what he calls the low quality of educational research in higher education, which we can argue about whether the quality of the education is good and the quality of the evidence is good. I think we have a lot of evidence. I mean, the problem in higher education or in education more broadly isn't that we don't know what to do. The sticky bit is why we don't do it in a more systemic way. So I think we know what works. So I think we have plenty of evidence for it. And you mentioned this a little bit earlier, where in my personal experience, and this tells us a lot about higher education, where people sometimes get hung up is they'll say, well, you know, that may have worked in physics, but it doesn't work in psychology. And most of that is nonsense. So can you show me some evidence of how this works in psychology? Sometimes that's just a delaying tactic to get to it. So quality of the work, quality of the evidence. But I think, and we can argue about whether those are real impediments to change or not. I think that they are brought up as impediments to change. The issue he identifies, which is interesting to me, is the unwillingness of leadership in higher education to devote the time and energy and resources to educational transformation. So, and I think that that's real. I think in my personal experience of higher education, executive leadership around educational innovation and change has been poor. It's not where, now I've spent my entire career at research universities. So different types of experiences, different kinds of institutions, different investment patterns, a different story about what that looks like. So those are the impediments that Bach talks about. And one of the things that certainly in the work at Michigan State that we took to be true in our experience was that there wasn't a question about what to do pedagogically or curricularly. We had lots of ideas about what to do. We had a pretty good understanding, and we thought that the people we worked with had a pretty good understanding of what to do educationally and why. I think most people were aligned about, you know, who's going to argue against a better student experience or better learning outcomes or closing opportunity gaps for minoritized students. Nobody's going to argue explicitly against that in public. And so we could get people aligned on the why as well. How was hard. How do we change? How do we structure change processes which are inclusive and participatory, have enough pace and agility to them that we can start to see some benefits sooner rather than later, that don't get us into 3-year planning cycles and 3-year pilots after which everybody's exhausted. And the first time you do something, it may not work particularly well. But you've spent 3 years on this and you spent a lot of money and you're exhausted. And so you're not going to do it again. And one of the things that we discovered is if we could get people to do something twice, that usually was enough activation energy for them to continue with the work towards a sustainability pathway. So I'm trying to pull back towards sustainability. Doing something twice was our little magical, it wasn't always true, but it was our little magical shorthand for. So I'm just trying to pull together those impediments to change with why design became an important mechanism for thinking very carefully about how, as a, I think how is a hard problem, and bridging a little bit in terms of how we tried to build sustainability into our into the work we did at Michigan State, and we're doing trying to do the same thing here at Leeds, in terms of leveraging design to move a little bit more iteratively and a little bit more quickly through change cycles, so that we could make our mistakes more quickly at a lower cost, and get people to do something twice on that pathway towards sustainable changes in their own practice. There's a lot going on there. I don't know whether Margaret, maybe neither you nor I are responding particularly well to Gabriel's questions, but hopefully that's particularly
the magic is emerging.
Absolutely. We have magic emerging.
So I'd like to take up that notion of time, because it was something I didn't mention with sustainability, but it is one of the big questions. We don't talk enough about time. My boss, Dave Bowder, this is another thing. I work with North Americans and they don't like the term boss. It sends shivers down their spine, but it's okay in Australia. It's affectionate. Dave says that, you never evaluate something on the first run, because it's never at its go. And in fact, even the second run can be a bit bodgy. There is something about letting things bed down, letting them take the time that they need in terms of sustaining. And also in terms of, I think you mentioned effort. And something I really notice is when you bring in change in higher ed, and this is not particularly research, this is just me having been around the block, people really kill themselves on that first iteration. They split blood and tears, and they really, because people really do care in this industry, they really put themselves into it, and then they are exhausted. And we often don't let people reap the benefit of their exhaustion of that work. We're suddenly, oh no, you've got to do something else and something new, rather than just holding back, letting them live with the successes or sometimes the failures that have happened without constantly asking them for more. And there's something also about rhythm there, rhythms.
I use the word rhythm all the time, and it's unusual. People accuse me of moving too fast and that I'm really interested in pace, but I'm mostly interested in rhythm.
Yeah.
Rhythm matters absolutely. And if you, so I won't go. I could, but I won't go on. So keep going.
I want you to go now.
Now you're talking about rhythm. I mean, particularly with the change work that we did at Leeds, we did move fast. We did start very fast. Mm. And part of that was overcoming inertia, particularly at the scale at which we were working. And so I did start fast. But after that, I was really trying to get people into a rhythm. And that was challenging too, because there was no history here, and I think this place is not unusual, of educational change or innovation work having a kind of rhythm over time. Mm-hmm. I think you're on to some, time really does matter. And Kairos, the magical concept is a time concept, right? Yeah. It's just not a chronological, there's Chronos, right? Which is chronological time. And there's Kairos, which is episodic time, right? Yeah. And both time concepts really matter, absolutely. But I told you I could go on. But really quickly, we're trying to get, and we're still struggling with that, to be honest with you, a couple of years into the program, of keeping people in a rhythm of work, which if we get it right, doesn't overwhelm them. They can do other things in their lives, but they also can't put their educational innovation work on the shelf for 8 months, because once you do that, you're fundamentally restarting the project. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And this, So I'm just thinking as you're talking about. One of the things, Deakin runs in trimesters, not in semesters. We have three equally spaced teaching terms. And it's a bit, they're good reasons to do that, and they're student reasons to do that. But it's very punishing on staff. It's super punishing. And you start to realise how much, you talked about Kairos, how much the heartbeat of the university is around those semester times. It's assessment time. It's first day of term, now we're midway through, and we run on that known rhythm. And we just had the glory of, well, particularly in Australia, which where it's over summer, the glory of the break where nothing happened, the one time a year. And we do feed off these in terms of going with the grain, a grain that perhaps we we can change it, but it's so embedded in what we do. And yet I think we don't think about it enough. We don't think about it in terms of funding. We don't think about it in terms of cycles of work. When you do educational research, I mean, it's really difficult. It's got to be collected within that term time pattern data if you're collecting data from students. Yet, you know, so many things conspire against it. So I'm just sort of thinking more about what drives the rhythm of a university.
Well, nothing particularly thoughtful, right?
Yeah.
I think I've thought about this a lot because it is the rhythm of the academic term, right? And it is, I mean, Leeds's academic rhythms are even stranger, that we have both terms and semesters at the same time. It's incoherent, and it's not optimal for learning because we find ourselves in these moments in which, like right now, students have come back to take assessments after a long break. So they've had a bunch of teaching, they've taken a long break, and now we're going to come back and assess them. Well, there's all sorts of cognitive reasons why this is a terrible idea, particularly depending on what they did during that time. They might have consolidated during that time, right? It might have been a brilliant break, but I don't think there was a whole lot of consolidation going on. Nothing about that term is driven by habits and history and academic conferences and, you know, research. It's not driven by these institutions have muscle memory, and what we also don't do a really good job of is pulling academics out of those normal rhythms and saying, you know, for a period of time, we can afford for you to spend your time thinking and doing. We do research sabbaticals. We do this on the research side easily. Educationally, we don't do it easily at all. In fact, we have a real hard time doing that. So I think we lack creativity and generosity with regard to thinking about academic time and educational work, both on the student side and on the academic side. It would be interesting to start over.
Yeah, but
design it.
We could design it.
You know, and to be the naysayer, I once did a project on assessment design, and we went off and as we were interviewing folk about the units, why they were doing assessment and how the assessment was changing, I started to realise that there were units that people were coordinating that were older than anyone on the team. So, and those units had just gone on and accreted like barnacles, mollusks, and so that assessment had become so stuck to them that it didn't matter what the teacher came in and did. In fact, that unit just had a life of its own. It would continue onwards. I don't know if I have a particular solution for that, but I do know that what it sometimes means is the older the university, the more traditional the university, the more difficulty it has with that sort of change. And those very young, it's like when you set up a new unit, you can do anything you want with the assessment. You can be as free as a bird, but there's something about tradition, which I don't think we should break. I think, again, it's very human. We want to have those things, but at the same time, it does hold us back.
Yeah.
It makes us hidebound.
No, I think it's true. I think in the UK, the younger universities have a reputation for being much more dynamic and malleable in a positive way, less hidebound and less tradition-bound and more student-centric.
Robert, tell me what you hear.
Okay. I have maybe a micro level idea that listeners might want to implement in their day-to-day work, whether that's at the university or elsewhere, which is, I don't know if anyone, my colleagues at Light will have heard of this concept because it's something that I'm always banging on about. Some of you may have, and it's the Japanese concept of ikigai, and you're nodding.
I'm nodding.
That's her pensive face.
That's my pensive face, saying I've nodded and now you're going to ask me to say what ikigai is, and
my colleagues will be thinking, oh, he's banging on about it yet again. And it's just... it's a framework that helps you to do things that you find meaningful and purposeful. And I think it's something that you can look at on a micro level, i.e. yourself, but also maybe embedded into design and student education, in my opinion. And that's combining something you love, something you're good at, something the world needs, and the last one, which is feels more instrumental, but it's something you can be paid for, which is why I was say it last. And maybe in relation to this conversation around design, thinking about how some of these kind of principles can be, you know, a thread that binds together aspects of design, whether that's in a project you're involved in, a piece of work you're doing, a course you're leading.
for life?
A lifestyle, a way of seeing life and a way of seeing work, learning. So maybe it wasn't so micro after all.
I had never, I don't know this guy. This is, I have learned something. This is a revelation to me. This is, I'm so glad I'm here.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, no, sorry, I don't mean to go on. That was great. Keep going.
Okay. So it's something that I learned about during lockdown. I think a lot of people were evaluating, you know, those sorts of wider questions. And kind of when you talk about life, the meaning of life, I think it's to find meaning. And that is such an important aspect of education we were talking about earlier, Margaret. And you were using some kind of, I think, concepts and terms from Hellenic philosophy earlier. So that thing of the telos, the purpose, what are we trying to achieve? Why are we learning? And stopping and constantly evaluating that. And I think these sorts of reflective practices that engage with your more profound, maybe, aspects of why you're doing what you're doing, I think they're challenging, but they're important, I think. And I think we can embed them in our work.
I was actually reflecting on that, thanks, Robert, on the back of some of the work that Light is embarking right now in terms of supporting people to feel better aligned in their own inquiry in education, better aligned with the institution, and therefore possibly have more impact in their innovation. And so, and there's an element, and I think actually that you know, Japanese concept actually is quite nice, how it brings all the different aspects together. But I suppose, in a way, this is related to my question about, are we assuming an average teaching practitioner and an average institution? What's the role of academic freedom in all of this? And should we redefine it or even define it? I mean, I suppose it's part of actually this idea that we do a lot of things without design and without that we've just inherited, you know, like the timetables and the cycles and the fact that we care about these things and maybe not others. And so how can we actually bring it all together in a meaningful way by rethinking what is academic freedom and how much to support people to, while aligning themselves to what the world needs, what the institution needs, still have their own the things that motivates them and therefore contribute better to student experiences at the end of the day.
Okay, I have a view. I have views about many things, but this is not a terribly. I'm sort of thinking that, you know, academic freedom has a very particular meaning in Australia because it's kind of a protected right. Basically, if you're going to have a view that might be counter to something, let's just call it that. You have a protected right. I don't think that's what you mean. I think you mean something else. And what I I'll go back to the design issue again. What I sometimes think, if you think about with Peter Goodyear, and I was talking about setting up a design space for education, you put things into place. And then the students inhabit it. And I think what you do when they inhabit it, the best sorts of design give them the freedom to bring themselves to it. So they bring their own unique ways of doing, of saying, and they can see something of themselves in the space that you've built. And I think that that's the same thing for teachers. When teachers teach, they need to bring something of themselves to it. I don't think it's the same as academic freedom. I do think that's essential. And I think those two things, maybe what people want is to know that they count as teachers, that their views and their beliefs and their ways of seeing the world really matter. And I think that's something that can be given to people. But everyone has to work within constraints. It's like it's not like there's some unbridled, outside of that sort of legally protected right for whatever reasons. I don't think there's really some unbridled sort of academic freedom that we can just run around and do whatever it is we want. We do work within a large body of constraints, and I think that just reframing it as bringing yourself as an educator would probably do it for me.
No, I think that makes sense. I agree with you that, particularly in higher education, that concept of academic freedom is a tricky one and often gets used as an excuse not to do things or an excuse to leave me alone and let me do whatever I want to do. And that's not what academic freedom actually means in terms of what you're talking about, Margaret. But you know, constraints, you know, like the sonnet, like the sonnet in poetry, it forces some creativity, right? So constraints are resources for creativity, and I agree with you. We do operate within those constraints. I think where we get into trouble is when we constrain and tighten down those constraints on teachers so much that they can't bring themselves, their full selves, their identities, their creativity, their intellectual passions. That hurts them, and it hurts education. It hurts students. And so, and there's lots of, I mean, this is an interesting thing. There are lots of education reform efforts, and I'm thinking about the U.S. context now, more specifically, that were driven by the angels. I mean, these were good ideas in their inception, but the outcome of that was to tighten down the constraints on teachers so much that it killed the intellectual work and the passion of teaching, and that will never produce the kinds of outcomes that we want. So I'm a big believer in constraints, actually, as a resource for thinking and creativity. But there has to be, I think there has to be the space to create and to be fully human. And there also has to be the obligation to do that, right? So the responsibility of the teacher in that space is to be creative and fully human. That's the job. And so I think that's an important part of the equation as well. If we aren't willing to do that as teachers, we're not doing it. We're not doing the work that we need to do. And we're not leveraging the gift that the constraint gives us and the opportunity gives us to be ourselves.
And these are at the heart of design, right? I mean, at least from an engineering perspective, what else are user requirements if not constraints, you know, for operating in certain scenarios?
Yeah. Now, I'm in the design work that we do here, and certainly that we did at Michigan State, we were big on constraints. We wanted them on the table. They are resources for thinking, and to ignore them. I mean, I actually think the bad design, bad learning design, is when you put people in a room and say there are no constraints. Yeah. You have complete freedom. In my experience, people shut down. That's hard to think without constraints. And so I do think constraints are really powerful resources for creativity.
No disagreements from me.
Can I bring in another analogy from maybe design in an engineering perspective? You know, I'm originally a chemist, but I worked in an engineering school, and I had to at least be conversant with some of these concepts from an engineering perspective and in relation to design. And and there's an element that actually I hadn't, you know, noted as a scientist, in terms of always looking for the answer or the optimization of absolutely everything. Well, engineers work with this concept of good enough. And so you were talking earlier, Jeff, about the role of executive leaders and leaders, you know. So what happened with this good enough in a world of rankings, you know, and the consequences of that kind of thing for designing great student experiences?
I don't want to answer that question.
I'll answer it bigger.
Go ahead.
So I think that they're just two different worlds.
Yeah.
I mean, we have to play, for want of a better word, the rankings game. We exist in a society where rankings matter, where they count, and, you know, we can write papers that might say we don't believe in rankings, but yet they are, if you like, the constraints within the world in which we live. And so we have to work with them. But that doesn't mean that, and it's kind of like a worldview difference. So a ranking is a set amount. It is an answer that has a solution and that has a singular solution. And for me, in design work, and it is about, you know, solutions. There isn't, it's not just that it's good enough, it's that it's good, that it's particular, that it's in this right time and place, that it's all those things, and that's just a different way of looking at the world. And we have to play both games at once, I think. And I think due respect to management, my funny years, to use that childish term again, coming into play. I think that's the game that you're in some ways you're charged with.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, that's a good answer. I mean, it's a measure. It gives us a measure, and I don't have a problem with the measure, but I have a problem with it as the only measure. And particularly some of the things that we get measured on educationally with regard to rankings don't have anything to do with education. They have to do with important things like experience in the case of the NSS, which is something that I think is really powerful. I'm a big believer in designing experiences. So we have to take those issues seriously, but not too seriously. And I think the real trick for good leadership in higher education, and I mean this at the board level as well as the executive level, is to take them seriously, but not too seriously. I do believe in accountability, and those measures and those rankings are one of the ways to hold ourselves accountable for the outcomes of our work. So no issues with them whatsoever, but need to be a little bit thoughtful about what we measure and how we measure, and how much variation we're willing to tolerate in the solution sets, because there isn't one thing that you can do to measure to move some of those measures. We live in a system, and moving systems is exceptionally difficult to do. It's where we started, right? We started with a description of that system, which plays into sustaining change. And if you want to change a poor ranking measure, you're going to have to change, which means you're going to have to move a system at some way, shape, or form to sustain it.
I suppose for me, it's like you've got to be responsive, but we shouldn't be reactive.
Right.
And I'm mindful of the time. I think the magic emerged. So thanks very much for your contributions. Can I ask you to go around very briefly? I mean, one thing that all of you got us from the conversation, although probably we know what Jeff is going to say, but for me is the notion of narrative, of episodal time, and presumably in connection also with narratives and stories as well. Margaret?
I think really similar. I think really that sort of reattention to rhythm and the role that it plays, and yeah, lots rattling around. Too difficult to capture in a couple of words.
Thank you.
So what's this Japanese concept again?
Ikigai.
Say it for me again.
Ikigai.
Can you spell it for me?
Ikigai.
Okay, good.
I may not be pronouncing it correctly.
Yeah, no, that's all right. I'm going to be that resonates with me, and it's the thing I'm gonna take it away and play with it, because I think it is a design arc. It's also really countercultural in so many ways. Mm. I mean, I was having a conversation with a colleague about her wishes for her daughter, for her university experience, and it was that she wanted her daughter to be happy and to thrive. And I remember, saying something very countercultural to my kids. My kids said, well, no other parent is talking about this. I wanted them to be happy and to do something that they loved, and that had meaning to them. That was my only expectation for their university education. And I think that is hopefully delightfully countercultural. But I think the Japanese concept gives a framework for how you get to an answer to what do I want out of my education, or what do I want out of my program? So obviously I'm rambling now, Gabriel.
That's all right.
This is I learned something today that I'm going to continue to work with. So thank you.
Fantastic.
And Robert, one thing that you take home?
I think this has confirmed many things in a really positive way that I've identified that are important. And it's also given me energy to tackle some really complex but important challenges that we're facing. We're working with, and that's quite a broad answer, but it's the best answer I've got.
Brilliant. Thanks very much. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.